Judges 16 then. Judges 16 for the last time on the life of Samson. Now, I know it's not really the season for it anymore. I think about, wasps. Our wasps, or I could say wasps, just to be local for you. But I'm going to stick with what I know. I'm going to say wasps. You sit outside in the summer, you go out on the picnic bench, you've got your glass of orange juice or whatever, and within minutes, they're there. They're hovering, they're trying to get in your juice. And there are times in the summer where I'd be pleased with myself because during the course of one meal with my knife, I managed to get about three of them in one go. You can squash a few wasps over the course of a mealtime or just while you're having a drink. But you've not actually dealt with the problem, have you? If all you've done is squashed a few wasps, you've not actually dealt with it, because there's still a wasp's nest somewhere nearby. And if you really want to get rid of them, what do you need to do? Well, you need to find the nest. You need to pour some chemicals or some boiling water down there. Swatting away a few wasps doesn't actually deal with the problem. There are thousands more out there. Now, every victory so far in the book of Judges has been the equivalent of swatting wasps at the picnic table. There's been all sorts of enemies that have come and fought against Israel. You've had judges like Barak and Gideon, and they've won various victories against the enemies. But we've seen so many times, haven't we? Nothing really changes at all. All that happens is another enemy pops up and they start oppressing Israel. And nothing changes in Israel's hearts. They turn away from God again and again. That downward spiral of apostasy just keeps on going and going. We've had 15 chapters of it now. But in Judges 16, it all changes. And that system itself, the whole downward spiral, crumbles to the ground. That's why this is such an exciting chapter. Finally, something is actually going to change. It's a chapter with three acts, so I want you to imagine this is a bit like a play where you have several acts. We've got three acts, and then having looked at the three acts, we're then going to look at two types of people that are represented in this chapter. But firstly, the three acts themselves. And then the first one, Act 1, is Samson and the harlot, which is verses 1 to 3. Now, it seems like 20 years have passed since Judges 15, since the encounters that have taken place with the Philistines then. Because that's how the end of chapter 15 finishes. After all that stuff, he judges Israel 20 years in the days of the Philistines. So the implication, I think, is it's been 20 years of relative peace. Samson's been judging Israel. And after 20 years, you might think, oh, well, maybe a corner's been turned here. But then, bang, chapter 16, verse 1, Samson's drawn back to his old temptations again. It says he goes down to Gaza, he sees a prostitute, and he has sexual relations with her. Once again, women are a snare to Samson. And you just think, Samson, haven't you learned? Come on, didn't you see what happened with your Philistine wife back in chapters 13 and 14? Haven't you seen the big forest fires? So last time we saw just how much things escalate from such something so tiny to enormous national warfare. I've been a Christian about 20 years now. That 20 years thing rings a bell for me. And just like Samson, I can now say, 20 years ago, I had such high hopes for myself as a Christian. I would have thought, in 20 years, I've had so many opportunities, I'll have listened to so many sermons, I could have read so many books, I'll have learned so much. I'm sure, I was naive, I'll have dealt with all these big sins, I won't have these sorts of struggles anymore. Oh, think, 20 years of Christian growth, what will I be then? And then 20 years pass, and you realise that your progress is so stuttering compared to what you would have wanted it to be. And that's Samson here, 20 years, and there he is, again, going down to Gaza, the same old stuff again. Maybe you feel like that, and it's not 20 years for you. It's 30, 40, 50 years of being a Christian. And the same things you battle with that you did when you were first converted. Don't feel like you're the odd one out. You're not. These sorts of things are here in the Bible for a reason. But also don't grow weary of fighting those battles. The temptation can be to think, well, after 20 years, after 30, what hope is for me now? Maybe I should just give up. No, God's sanctifying you. He's being patient with you. You will be growing. Keep going and give thanks. What a patient Saviour we have. After all these years, here we are, still struggling with the same things. How patient he is with us. But you know, another thing that's still happening after 20 years is that the Philistines still hate Samson. Nothing's changed there. They seem to have been waiting a long time to get revenge on him. And then all of a sudden, the opportunity arises. The news comes through to him in verse 2. Samson is in Gaza. Gaza is one of the big Philistine cities. So there he is. They go and surround him. They lie in wait all night. And the plan is when they get to morning, when it's daylight, they'll kill him. They think they've got their man this time. But we're told instead, Samson gets up at midnight. He picks up the doors of the gate of the city and the two gateposts. He puts them on his shoulders. He carries them up to the top of a hill. Their best efforts have been thwarted. Their best plans they're just gone in a moment. Why? What's happening here? Well, what we've got to remember is Samson is God's anointed, God's chosen one. We saw back in chapter 13, he's the anointed, the Nazarite, the one who will begin to deliver Israel. And until that happens, he's immortal. Samson can't die until God has done what he's going to do with Samson. Until that point, he will not die. And until the end of chapter 16. That's why he can escape here. But later on, he'll be captured. That's the first act, verses 1 to 3. Samson and the harlot. Secondly, act 2, Samson and Delilah, verses 4 to 21. Well, the Philistines have come to realise they can't take Samson by force. So they change their tactic. They'll take him by stealth instead. Because they've learned, one thing they've learned is, this is a man with a weakness. And we know what his weakness is, don't we? His weakness is women. We've just seen that in the first few verses. So, verse 4, we're told, he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek. Now, I think we're sort of meant to have mixed feelings about this, that the valley of Sorek is in Judah. So, although we're not specifically told whether Delilah is a Philistine or Israelite or whatever else, she's living in Judah. So I think it's a pretty good guess that she is an Israelite. And so you think, well, great, well done. You've married an Israelite. Great sign, well done, Samson. After all his dalliances with Philistine women, now he hitches up with an Israelite. But there's also a problem, and that problem comes out very quickly. If she's not a Philistine, she's very clearly aligned to them. Her loyalty is to them, and not to God's people, and most certainly not to Samson. Verse 5, the lords of the Philistines. In other words, the ruling elite, the top dogs, the people who call the shots. They tell her, entice him. Find out the secret of his strength. And she's all too willing to be complicit in all of this. So in verse 6, she starts to ask him where his great strength comes from. In verse 7, he makes something up. He says, oh, well, if I'm tied with 7 bowstrings that aren't yet dried, I won't be able to escape. And you notice something here. He doesn't tell her the truth. Why not? You know, this is a woman. He loves this woman, we've been told. But he doesn't tell her the truth. Why? Well, the only reason can be he doesn't trust her. He doesn't trust her with his secret. I think what's happening here, when it says he loves her, what's happening here is he's fallen head over heels for someone who may be a very attractive, physically alluring, great sense of humour, fun to be around. I don't know, I'm speculating. You know, he's attracted to her, he's head over heels, but he's attracted to her outward qualities, but he also knows in his gut, I can't trust that woman, I could never trust her with anything. Samson, what are you doing? From verses 8 and 9, she ties him up. And the Philistines turn up, lying in wait, and she shouts out, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson!" And the strings just sort of cling off him as he flexes his muscles. And the same cycle repeats itself a second time, verses 10 through to 12. And this time it's with new ropes that have never been used. So verse 13, she says, "Oh, you're mocking me. You're telling me lies. Come on, Samson, tell me the truth." And then this time, third time, he says, "Oh, it's if you weave seven locks of hair into the loom." Verse 14, the same thing happens again. Three times it's happened now. So this time, verse 15, she says, "Three times now this has happened. You don't really love me, do you?" Verse 16, it says, she pestered him daily. She pressed him. And previous weeks we saw Samson calling his wife, his previous wife, a heifer. And we said, advice to the husbands, never a good idea to call your wife a heifer. Well, tonight, some free advice for you wives. It's not a good strategy to pester someone and wear them down daily, like she's doing. I know it works, but that's not the lesson we're going to take from that. So things for the husbands and wives. She presses on him. She wears him down with what she's doing day after day. And verse 17, it says, he tells her all his heart. He tells her he's a Nazarite. If my hair's shaved, I'll lose my strength. So verse 18, she tells the Philistines, they trundle off again, they're ready to capture him. They're really that determined. They desperately want him. Verse 19, she lulls him to sleep on her knees. And if you remember the story of Jael, quite a similar sort of thing happening here with her and Sisera. She lulls him to sleep, has his hair shaved off. And in the moment she gets what she wants, she starts to torment him. Notice that. She changes the moment it happened. See, she doesn't love him. She's using him. This is like, you know, in the cartoons where there's some sort of beautiful princess. And then the moment something happens, she rips her mask off. And behind it is this hideous, grotesque monster that's wicked or some sort of alien. You know, it's that sort of thing. She's been this alluring character. And then the moment she's got him, she changes. She reveals her true colours. She torments him. So we're told his strength left him. Verse 20, he sort of says the same sort of thing again. "Oh, well, I'll fight them off, just as I did before." But it's these tragic words. He did not know that the Lord had departed from him. Important we get things the right way round in terms of the sequence of events here. Samson left the Lord, and then the Lord left him. Samson, I think, when he was giving himself to Delilah, you know, he was giving himself away to another lover. He gave his heart to her, and he was turning away from the Lord, turning away from his Nazarite calling that the Lord had given him. So verse 21, the Philistines take him, they gouge his eyes out, they put him in chains, they take him to Gaza, and there we're told he becomes a grinder in the prison. Grind here is one of these sexual euphemism words. You sometimes come across this in the Bible. Grinding is a word for sexual contact. So the point is, Samson's grinding, he's going off with other women in this way, he's going off with Delilah, has led to him becoming a grinder. It's sort of a play on words that doesn't come through in our language. It's sort of, Samson, this is where you've ended up through what you've done, through the decisions you've made. It's a really sad story. You sort of feel the sadness of it. Samson, what have you done? And you know, it would be totally hopeless if it depended on Samson now. But I think that's where Samson needs to reach. He needs to reach a point where he realises it's not actually about his own strength at all. Samson, your power is not your own, and it never was your own. He seems to have thought it was in some way. You know, sometimes we need that too. Sometimes we can forget, and we can think we're in control. We can think our own intelligence or our powers of persuasion or our wealth or whatever it is. We can start trusting in those things. I think Samson trusts in his physical strength. He thought, well, I'll just get up. I'll solve my problems again, because this is me. Sometimes we've got to get to a point where we realise there are problems I cannot solve myself, and I need the Lord to rescue me. Act 3, Samson and the Philistines, verses 22 to the end of the chapter. Verse 22, Samson's hair starts to grow back. But here's one of the misunderstandings I think we sometimes have. Sometimes we think his hair is some sort of secret weapon, like a magic potion, if you like. But, you know, he didn't actually lose his strength because his hair was cut. He lost it because he departed from the Lord, or because the Lord departed from him. And equally, as we're told he's growing his hair, one thing we've got to say is happening is Samson is consciously returning to the Lord. He's returning to his Nazarite calling. He's willing to give himself to the Lord's work again. Verses 23 and 24, the Philistines are already celebrating. They've got their man. They know who it is who's done it. It's their god, Dagon. So they've got together to offer Dagon sacrifices, to drink, to sing his praises, to celebrate. Dagon's won the great victory. We've got our man. Verse 25, they call for Samson to be brought out to entertain them. It just says that he may perform for us. I don't know what sort of performances Samson would have had to do for them. But I think one thing we can say is, you know, don't think of your Strictly Come Dancing, you know, your classical performances in that sense. This must have been something utterly degrading, humiliating. That sort of, you know, it's like performing inverted commas. But you know, they're so premature in their celebrations. They're celebrating as if the battle's already won because they've got their men, but it's premature. As Samson calls to the boy, led him by the hand. He says, just let me lean my hands on the pillars of the temple. We're told the temple's packed full of men and women, 3,000 of them, the lords of the Philistines. This is a who's who of the nation. Everyone who's anyone is there. Now let's put this in context before we get to the end of this act. Samson's present in Hebrews 11. I don't know what you make of that as we've read through this story, because Samson's done some pretty rotten stuff so far, but we're also being told in Hebrews he's a man of faith. And I would say to you, it's in this moment here that, in spite of all his previous moments of unfaithfulness, all his failures, he carries out one great earth-shaking act of faith. I'd say it's for this act that he's in Hebrews 11. Verse 29, he prays, O Lord God, remember me, I pray. Strengthen me, I pray, just this once, O God, that I may with one blow take vengeance on the Philistines for my two eyes. And we're told he puts his hands on the pillars of the temple. He says, let me die with the Philistines. He pushes with all his might, and the whole temple comes crashing down. Samson dies. But he dies along with the rest of the Philistines who are there, the lords of the Philistines. And you know, every other battle he's fought against them just pales into comparison with this one. You know, back in chapter 15, he killed 1,000 of their men with the jawbone of a donkey. But you know what that was? It was just swatting away a few wasps. With this act, the whole Philistine system is smashed. You know, their royalty, their judges, their army commanders, their prison officers, their chief medical officer, their home secretary, their economy, their politics, their government, everyone, all the leaders of every department, there, the whole system of the enemy comes crashing to the ground as Samson dies. You know, just think about Samson, how encouraging it is that Samson finishes so much better than he starts, with this act of faith, giving his life for the freedom of his people. Maybe you can look back on many years now of battling to serve the Lord faithfully. And maybe you look back at when you were first a Christian and think, I just feel like my most faithful years are all behind me now. I look at the things I used to do, and then I look at me now and think, oh, it's all behind me now. The best years of my faith have gone. Oh, look at Samson. Look at how he finishes. Look at the stuff he did before, but look, he demonstrates in his death more faith than he did throughout the rest of his life. You know, it may well be that your greatest acts of faith are yet to come. They're not the ones you think they are. Well, last part of tonight, there's two pictures we're meant to see in this chapter. The first one is this. Samson here is a picture of Israel. We said this at various points. Samson embodies the nation of Israel. That last verse, how the whole book of Judges closes, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And we saw previously that that same concept, that same wording, is used to describe Samson as he pursues women. And the point is that Samson represents the nation of Israel. God had chosen them. They were to be a Nazarite people, set aside, holy, for God alone, just like Samson, a holy calling. But Israel responds, just like Samson does. Israel goes after other gods. She prostitutes herself. She pursues others. She stays away from God. And yet she still seems to think, well, we'll always be saved. So later on, in other books like Jeremiah, people in Israel are saying, well, we'll always be safe. We've got the temple. We'll be fine. Here we are on Mount Zion. No one could ever take our mountain, could we? And just like Samson, they don't realise God's left them. There's a picture here that Israel, where Israel are meant to see themselves in what's happening with Samson. It's interesting to look at the punishments that happen to Samson, the things he goes through, the torture, because, do you know, so many of them are a picture of the covenant curses, the punishments that Israel as a nation will receive for their unfaithfulness. You might want to turn to Deuteronomy 28 just for a moment. We're going to see various aspects of Deuteronomy 28 being played out in Samson's life. So it's Deuteronomy 28 verses 28 to 29. Notice what God says there about the people of Israel. If they turn away from him, if they disobey the covenant, it says they will be struck with blindness and grope about. It's Deuteronomy 28, verses 28 and 29. It's no coincidence then that Samson's eyes are gouged out. Samson gropes about in blindness. A few verses on. Deuteronomy 28, verse 32, it says, their sons and daughters shall be given to another people, and there shall be no strength in your hand. And that's what happens to Samson. He's separated from his family, from all of Israel. He's in the lair of the enemy, of the Philistines, and there's no strength in his hands. He can't do anything there. A few verses on, Deuteronomy 28, verse 48, says, they'll serve their enemies. They'll wear a yoke of iron on their necks. And that's what happens to Samson. He's enslaved. He becomes a grinder working in the prison there for the enemies. See, again and again in this chapter, Samson is living out the covenant curses of Israel. And you know, this should have been a massive wake-up call for them. They knew their Bibles. They knew these curses. They should have seen what was happening to Samson as a picture of what was going to happen to them. But you know, because of that, they should also have read into what happened when they saw the temple collapsing. Because in that happening, it's a great picture of what God is going to do for them. In spite of their covenant disobedience, the whole structure is coming down, the old covenant, the ministry of death, as the Apostle Paul calls it, is going to be torn down and replaced with a new covenant. Covenant that depends on the sacrificial obedience of a deliverer. And that leads us on to our second picture I'm going to see here, which is that Samson is a picture of Christ. Let's just think about the journey we've gone on through Samson's life. Back in chapter 13, we saw Samson being born a Nazarite from birth with the visit of an angel, and we said that there's a picture there of Jesus. Born a great Nazarite, a holy calling. Chapters 14 And 15, Samson's struggling to live out that calling. He's turning away from that. But Jesus, by contrast, lives it out perfectly. He embraces his calling. Chapter 15, what we saw in Samson was that we saw him being a solitary deliverer. He and he alone, no army with him. Just like Jesus goes to the cross alone. But chapter 16, the picture of Christ comes into even closer focus. Remember back in verses 1 to 3. Samson, God's chosen deliverer, is surrounded by his enemies. Thirsty for blood. Desperate to get it. But Samson just walks through free. We're going to see a picture of Jesus there. Remember how there were various times that Jesus was surrounded by people who wanted to take him, arrest him, and kill him. But on multiple occasions, he just walks through the crowds. He slips away unnoticed. Why? Because God's chosen deliverer can't die until God's chosen time, until his work is done. God was preserving him until the moment of the cross. When the time is right, Jesus is betrayed by a close companion for money. Judas, one of the 12. Just as Samson is betrayed as well by his lover, Delilah, this woman he should have been able to trust. Samson's eyes gouged out, being led around by this small boy. Again, Jesus, blindfolded, repeatedly hit in the face. The same sort of picture. We saw how Samson is paraded before the enemy. He's there in the temple, all the lords of the Philistines there. He's forced to perform for the mocking crowds. And the blindfolded Jesus is mocked as well. And they try and make him perform too. He's blindfolded, but they say, "Prophesy, which one of us was it that struck you?" They want him to perform for him. Samson, the great warrior, is utterly humiliated. Experiences covenant curses for Israel's disobedience. And that's what Jesus is experiencing on the cross. The curse of the covenant. The wrath of God for his people's disobedience. Samson reaches the temple. He's there in the lion's den, in the den of the enemy. And they're rejoicing. They've already won their great victory. We've got our man. Samson cries out to the God who's already departed from him. And Jesus himself, he's hanging there on a cross. He's helpless. His enemies are certain he's powerless now. But we've got our man. So they can mock. Can shout, "Oh, if you're really the King of the Jews, save yourself now." And in the midst of that mocking, Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Samson lets out a final cry, asks the Lord for strength one last time. And then he stretches his arms out to the left and to the right. And with strength that can only come from God himself, he dies. And he lets out a final cry, but with Samson, it's not a cry of defeat. It's a triumphant cry. He's winning more in his death than he did throughout the whole of his life. That's what we've been told in these verses. A cry of strength. A cry that says the work is done. A cry that says it is finished. That's what Jesus shouts on the cross. As Samson dies, he doesn't die alone. He dies alongside sinners, crooks, thieves. That's where Samson is. You know, in the lion's den, amongst the enemies, those who hate God, those who worship Dagon. Jesus dies numbered with the transgressors, among the common thieves, the criminals of the day. But in Samson's dying, he achieves more than he ever does in his living. Because what Samson's doing is he's exposing the Philistine gods as dumb and inept and powerless. Their own temple, Dagon's temple, falling to the ground, and Dagon is powerless to do anything about it. Just at the point where Dagon's going to be celebrating this victory, where all the people are rejoicing in what their great god Dagon has done, he's exposed as completely powerless and inept. Great picture, isn't it, of what Jesus is doing at the cross. Colossians 2:15. He disarmed principalities and powers. He made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them in it. You know, at the cross, Jesus isn't swatting at wasps, is he? The whole opposition decisively conquered. The powers of death and hell reign no more. The whole system of wickedness defeated in one moment. A once-for-all victory. It's only one way that that can happen. You know, with Samson, what sets him apart from all the other judges that have gone before is he acts alone as one man to die on behalf of his people. I hope you can see all these similarities that we're meant to see here. Samson lays down his life to defeat the enemy, the Philistines. None of the other judges do that. They bring out their armies, they win their victories, these temporary defeats of the enemy. And so the cycle of apostasy keeps just going round and round. What is it that breaks the cycle and brings it all crumbling to the ground? It's a deliverer who will wage war on God's enemies by laying down his own life. And that's what it takes for us. One saviour to break the chains of hell. And if you're trusting in Christ today, that's why we can say with certainty, the cycle of sin and death and hell is broken. It was broken on a cross outside Jerusalem that Friday, thousands of years ago. As the Saviour, with outstretched arms, gives his own life for his people. It's his victory, and it's our victory in him. Who's able to say before it happened, greater love has no man than this, that he lays down his life for his friends. In Samson we're seeing this great picture of Christ, of what he will do, the victory he brings for us. Let's close by singing a great victory hymn. It's 509, a hymn where we can simply rejoice again what Christ has done for us, and what he gives us in him. Let's stand and sing.